Accession number 28671, Mr. Ronnie Wheatman, Reel 9. Now, how long were you at Singapore?
I was at Singapore, where we are now, with about... Was it about
You've
May?
Gone in about May 46,
May,
I think.
May. I came back from Singapore in December of that year.
So, anything happened in those 7 months?
Yes. I set out to see as much of Malaya as I could. And we used to hire a 3-ton vehicle, and we used to go up into the centre parts of Malaya, into very isolated areas, to meet the people. And the people were so kind to us. We took photographs of them, the children, and as I say, have a lot of photos taken of families. And they were so kind. They're a classy sort of people. But when one escapade I've forgotten all about, when we were delivering rice, we found a very isolated village, and the headman of the village, when he greeted us, and he said he was only had one leg, and we said, "What happened with your other leg?" And he told us what had taken place. He said in 1941 we had two English men who had escaped from one of the Japanese camps, and we kept them for only a short time, about a week, and then they were handed to another village. Somehow the Japanese found out that they'd been in that village, and they said one morning they turned up, they said about 100 of them, they surrounded the village. All the males from granddads and all the children from 1 year old, they got them in the centre of the village, and they fastened them to various stakes in the ground, and they hacked one leg off every one of them. The number of people that died, of course, instantaneously, because they just bled to death. The wives and children, the women, had to witness it. Well, he said they went berserk. He said it was horrible. And he said how he lived, he doesn't know. But when this escapade finished, the Japanese officer said, "If we find you do this again, we come back and take the other leg." They were inhuman, but they were inhuman to their own selves as well. They treated themselves really horrible. And when I was in Singapore, and we had thousands of them there who did all sorts of work for months and months and months before they were repatriated, they used to go everywhere at a jog trot. And we used to watch some of the Japanese Imperial armies doing exercises on the beach. And they were only about 5'2" in height, very squat, but very powerful muscles, the leg muscles and arms, and we used to watch them what they did, and they formed pyramids, and then they would all line up on the sea. They only had a loincloth on, and they given signal from the army, the officer, and they'd all go in the sea, and they'd swim out, and they'd swim amongst the jellyfish, because the jellyfish, loads of them there, they'd be stung with jellyfish like the devil, but they didn't care a damn. But they came back, they kept themselves physically fit. And we used to say, no wonder the army had problems, because they were a tremendous fighting unit. And even though they were prisoners of war, they kept themselves so well organized and so clean. Their bodies were always clean, they were always watching themselves, but they looked evil. They did look really evil people. Really evil.
Now, what happened after this? You're exploring Malaya. Anything else?
Well, of course, you went round various islands. You met people. You saw the fishermen where they lived. I used to love to go out to where the fishermen lived. And they had floating sort of huts, which they fastened rocks to them to stabilise them, and used to fish all night, and used to go there and talk to them. And they could never understand why the English people were so kind towards the Japanese, said kind after they'd butchered you and did horrible things. They could never understand it. Well, we adhered to accord principles, of course, and that was it. The Japanese did.
Now, what happened next then? How long you were out there till?
December 1946.
With no particular duties?
No, you just nothing to do. You're sort of... Oh, I got the rank of corporal.
Tell me how that happened.
I'd been LAC for donkey's years, and then I remember it. One morning I was at RAF Changi, and I was sat in the canteen, and there was an army sergeant came in and he said, are you Wheatman? I said, yes, that's right. He said, will you go to the ordinary room? He said, I think you've got some promotion. And I said, whatever for? I said, well, it's because you've been out here some time, and I think you've been recognised. So I went there, and they said, well, you've got the status of being a corporal. And they gave me two stripes.
Did it make much difference?
It did. I can't remember now what the pay was. But you see, out there, you did get a lot of extra pay for being out there a certain length of time, or if you had been in battle zones, you got extra for that. There was always, it wasn't a lot, but put together, it didn't make you very wealthy. And another thing, I was a non-smoker, and I got tremendous amounts of these tins of cigarettes, especially Craven Air. So the Japanese used to crave for Craven Air because it was cork-tipped, and they used to neatly insert bits of opium in and this, that, and the other. So I made a bomb out of that, a genuine black market character, selling cigarettes.
When that I was to the, who did you sell to? To the Japanese?
The Chinese.
The Chinese, the China. I said Japanese. Yeah, no, I wonder
about. Yeah, the Chinese. Yes, the Chinese love them. Now, when I had to leave Malaya, I left it with a great deal of anguish because I found that it was such a beautiful country. And I know when I'm going past up the straits of Malacca, we passed where our Kuala Selangor, where our unit of AMS 637 had been stationed. And I know there was about 10 of us. And we were standing there at the rails, and we said, well, it's been a wonderful time out here in the last 6 months. Up till then, the horrible times you remember, but you cast them aside. And you gaze out and you see the flying fishes on the water. You see beautiful huge jellyfish going past you, and the swish of the water against the boats. And it's for me.
What about the voyage back home? Which ship were you on?
I was on the Georgic.
What was the trip like?
The trip was fantastic because it was a proper troop ship. It had proper bunks, and the food was excellent, and everything was fantastic. The only thing we went wrong was when we were off Ceylon. We called in at Bombay coming back for a week, so they allowed us ashore. That was a fantastic thing, to go back into Bombay, where we'd been, where you knew the areas and this, that, and the other. But going past Ceylon, there was an army general, I think he was, high ranking, and he died. Now, I never knew what happened on the boat when he died. The boat is stuck dead. There's no forward movement, it just wallows. And of course, this is quite with him being a high ranking officer, there's quite a ceremony. And the thing was that the bugles are sound, there's drums and everything, and the body goes down into the water with lead weights attached to it. But it was very strange for the boat to stop dead. Very strange indeed. And everybody was gathered on deck, minus the hats and all the rest of it, and a rattle of the drums, and this happened, and then engines were started, and off we went. And we had a very good journey back. When we got into the Mediterranean, we were given our proper clothing, which were warmer, the proper RAF uniform. Now, as we came past the Isles of Scilly, it was horrible, it was dull, and it was blowing a gale, and then up to Liverpool.
Now, this would be January 47 when you got back, would it?
This was December.
Still?
Yeah, December.
Okay.
And when we got into Liverpool, we hove to off Liverpool. Now, a lot of the army had married quite a number of Chinese and Japanese girls, and they brought them back with them. And I remember looking at them. They'd left a place of sunshine, of warmth, of everything that was beautiful. Liverpool looked damned awful. It was pouring with rain, it was cold, it was miserable. And I thought, God, what do you come to?
So what happened next then? You got ashore, December 46.
Got ashore, and I went to RAF Warden, where I was to be demobbed.
You were demobilised straight away, were you?
It was supposed to be, yes. Well, when I got there, of course, it took you about 3 days. But then when I got home, I got an urgent call from the ministry saying, would I like to rejoin?
Now, hang on. What was the demobilisation process you'd gone through? What happened?
The process was you were measured for a civilian suit. You had to pick whatever coloured you wished, pinstripes and all the rest of it, and different coloured shirts, ties, socks, shoes. You had to go and choose whatever colour you wished, and they were all yours. You tried them on, they fitted you, and if they didn't fit, then some tailor was there and said, within 24 hours, we'll have it fitting your body. And you give them money, etc. And then you're...
And that's December 46.
Yes.
Now, you immediately get out, what happens then? The ministry asks for you again.
Yes.
Tell me what's happening.
Well, when I got back home, of course, I talked to my mother and everything, and then they sent a telegram. Would, you see, in those days, the vast amount of telegrams floated about. Would I phone someone up? It was at Manchester. I did, and it was some officer, and he wished to see me, that whether I wished to be kept on in the RAF for an extra 3, 4, 5, or 10 years. And I thought it all out, and I went to see him. And I went back in the RAF for a further, first of all, for a further 6 years. Now, I was at home for about a month, and then went back. Now, those next years extended into about another 20 years, because I just kept on signing on.
So you served in the RAF from 1946 through to...
I served in the RAF from 1942.
When you rejoined, 46.
My service kept going, even though there was no break. And, of course, I went into this regarding pensions, etc. And, of course, it was to my advantage.
So you were in for how long?
From 1942 to 1974.
Now, we don't cover that in this book. Could you give us an outline of your service?
Outline?
Well, just what did you do?
When I rejoined, went back under radar. And within 3 weeks, I was given sergeant's rank, which was a fantastic thing. My pay rocketed up. And I became a radar supervisor. And I went round the country. My area to cover was from the northern border, from Northumberland, right down the east coast, the south coast, as far as Penzance.
And what does the radar supervisor do?
It was supervised. There were still masses of radar stations that were still in being. They were still utilised for movements of aircraft. There was still a lot of aircraft movement. And they were still manned by the RAF. So you had to go and see that everything was working according to what it should be, and that the staff themselves were getting proper training. And I got married then, and my wife kept with me for, and it was 14 years. We had trekked all over the place, to every, all sorts of places.
So you were constantly moving around all these bases throughout the UK?
That's
all
right. All around. So my, nowadays, well, when I term, even now, I get a tremendous amount of invites back again to RAF Station, RAF Leeming, Linton on Ouse, when Fillingley was open, and I still go back to, I get a lot of invites to RAF Fylingdales, the Ballistic Early Warning Missile Station. Have you been there?
So you were just checking the bases, checking the radar equipment was working.
That's right.
Did it ever change, or was that what you were doing right through?
No, right through. Never changed.
So you were Sergeant Radar Supervisor right from the end of the war to 74?
74, yeah.
And did the equipment change? How did the equipment change?
The equipment nowadays has changed so...
From
46 and 74, it was changing slowly because everything was becoming modernised. In fact, that before it was huge in itself. Now the concentration of receiver and transmitting was slowly getting smaller and smaller and smaller, and little apparatus like that is now being used, whereas before it would be 10 feet across, because a microchip, of course, has advanced everything.
And this was happening even in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, because, you see, we were invaded a lot by the Americans, who had formulated various things. They had a lot of money to play around with. We, in our government, were very slow in looking at these things and projecting money into various firms.
Now, what was the radar equipment, the stations? I mean, how many stations were there? I mean, were there still as many as there had been during the war?
No. They diminished by, I would say, during the war, the peak would be about 1,020 around England. In 74, they were down to, about 310. That was all around England.
And you were still monitoring and checking all these?
Oh, yes, because there was still the Cold War on with Russia.
Now, what was the role of these? What were these radar stations? What was their role in peacetime? I know it's the Cold War, but what was their role?
Well, their role was, of course, all the East Coast was to, my tongue was rattling away, was to monitor the Russian aircraft that were coming in, and they came into within 20 miles of the coastline hundreds of times, and then just turned around and waggled their wings against British fighter planes that went up. They waggled the wings at one another, and it was quite hilarious at times, but it was all the time tinged with problems, because we realised we had no idea what those Russian aircraft had on board, and it was tit for tat against one another. But that was going on all the time. And some of these come right round the top of Scotland, down the Irish Sea, these Russian aircraft, the Bear, and up the English Channel. And of course, you see, they would register their flight plan, where they were going to and everything. So it wasn't as though they were on some deadly mission. They just said, we're doing this trip on such and such a day at such and such a time, and we fly at such and such a height. Everything was spot on according to plan.
But you'd monitor it?
Oh, monitoring all the time, yes.
Now, any particular stories from this time? I mean, I know it's 30 years, and we're not doing it in such detail, but anything that springs to mind that's important to you to tell us?
visited so many. Yes, there was one, a red Ashiator called GCI Equipment, which was at Patrington near Hull, and it used to do a lot of concentrated work on approaching these Russian aircraft coming in, and two Americans were up in planes from Lake and Heath, and they'd gone very, very close. They really were close. We thought they were going to you know, crash into one of these huge planes, and it had to take very evasive action, and it went right down to about 200 feet above the water. And we all thought it was going to crash. It was, you know, where they were tracking it. And it didn't. It levelled out. But oh, was there some hellish sort of signalling went on between the Russian and the Americans over it. That they had been extremely foolish. Very foolish indeed. They'd gone too far.
So you were doing this until you retired in 1970. That's when you retired, did you? Yeah. Or did you leave and take up other employment?
No, it's here. I come to the end of sort of my career, and they wouldn't let me go in any further. But they still said, would you come back and help us if we require you? And I've been asked back time and time again to all over the place.
What do you do? As a consultant?
Yes, I go back, and they just say, please tell us what happened as you've been listening to me in such and such a year, with various types of equipment. And they take me to some station that's operating now. I go up back to Staxton Wold near Scarborough. And that is operating a lot with regard to the North Sea movement of aircraft.
Did you take another job? Or
oh, yes, I went into local government.
Now, what did you do in local government?
I was in Treasurer's, in the rating and valuation. And, of course, in local government, you were allowed to have this time off with being still on the list of reserve. So I used to get paid from the local government and used to get paid from the ministry.
And you were working in the Treasurer's, what as an admin officer or what?
No, on rating and valuation.
As a rating officer?
Mm.
And how long did you do that for, 74 to...
74 to 89.
Now you're also you're involved in what regimental association, not regimental, what RAF things are. You're very involved with something called RADAR. Could you explain what that is? We'll concentrate on that, I think.
I'm secretary of the RADAR Association, which is for Great Britain, Canada, New Zealand, Australia.
And what does the RADAR Association do?
Well, I'm at the moment getting together a big reunion at Coventry. I got one at Bournemouth last year, and that involved about 250 people.
And how many are there in the association?
How many are in the association? There are about 1,000 now.
And what's its purpose, would you say?
Well, its purpose is just to keep people together. When we get people together and they talk as to where they've been, way back in, you know, 1940s, the comradeship, and they're all married, they're all white-haired now, but there are things that we still remember with one another, where we assisted in knowing various radar stations, what the capabilities were, what the operators were themselves, and as a unit, well, we could all work together. And I'm also a member of the Aircrew Association. I'm also a member of the Blenheim Stocks, after one Blenheim's during the war. I'm a member of the Royal Observer Corps Association.
But the radar one's your main one?
Yeah, the Aircrew is my main one. I'm also a member of the Borneo and Malaya Association.
Now tell me about the Aircrew Association then. What does that do? That's your other...
That's meeting at Harrogate in October. Now, there again, there were 14,000 of us up to about 3 years ago. but we had an awful lot of dying, and we're down now to just over 8,000 people have reached an age of 80, and they've just died, and that's been it. But we're from all walks of life, and aircrew, of course, had tremendous losses, and in, of course, the commander, bomber command, or fighter command, and we don't tell silly stories. Stories are authentic of dreadful things that did occur, trying to get back to your base on one engine or something like that, or having half your crew that have been killed and trying to get back. But very courageous men, very courageous indeed, and a lot of stories have not been told of the things that they did, which they don't want to talk about.
Thank you very much indeed.